If you're a small organization that thinks that all the backup solutions are priced for large enterprises, this is the episode for you. Our guest has been helping companies and small government organizations in France build inexpensive storage solutions for backup purposes, built for way less money than they typically would be. I was really impressed by what he's been up to, and I think you will be too. Hi, and welcome to Backup Central's Restore It All podcast. I'm your host, W. Curtis Preston, a.k.a. Mr. Backup, and I have with me my USB connection consultant, Prasanna Malian. How's it going, Prasanna?
I'm good, Curtis. It shouldn't be that difficult with USBs. Come on.
It shouldn't be, but and yet you were able to, like, because it was like, why don't we connect the thing to the thing? But then if the thing's connected to the thing, you got the thing, you got the problem, you got the...
Maybe you should tell the listeners kind of what you were struggling with.
Yeah, well, I you know, it's funny. I've recently downgraded my monitor. I say that because I had a very nice Apple display. Those of you, the Apple purists are like, oh no, he got rid of his Apple display. It was a 10-year-old Apple display. And it was a really nice Apple display, but I got tired of converting everything, right? I have a more modern laptop. And so I was having to convert the Thunderbolt display port thing, as well as also converting the power. It was the old MagSafe style power connector to a USB-C style power connector, because I have the MacBook Pro now. And that was always just a source of
dongles and dongles and more dongles.
Way more dongles than I wanted to deal with. And now I'm very happy to say I have a single dongle, although because of various peripherals that have to do with this podcast, I have more peripherals that can be handled by said dongle. So there is technically a dongle off of the dongle.
there is a
USB hub. That, by the way, I did figure this out, Prasanna. I actually used some double-sided tape to stick the USB hub to the back of my monitor.
Yeah, then it's out of the way. So, you don't have to worry about it. You don't see it.
Exactly. But you may recall the various generations of cable mess that we went through trying to get my desktop to. And I think it's the only one that's not where I want it is the keyboard. I don't have a wireless keyboard. I have a USB keyboard, and the USB keyboard doesn't seem to want to plug into the USB hub that is plugged into the USB dongle that is plugged into the USB port. It only wants to be plugged into the dongle. But so, you know, just things.
So here's something. Problems. So here's something. Yeah. Right. So now Apple, right, or I should say the EU is trying to force everyone to use USB-C as the standard, right? So soon, I think in 2024, your iPhones will probably more than likely have USB-C.
Right. Yeah. Which is good. I mean, but at this point, I mean, I'm almost always wirelessly charging those. So that's not as big of a deal. But, and the other thing that happened is a complete office reorg. For those of you that, for the 13 of you that watch this via video, you'll notice that this wall is no longer peach. This wall is agreeable gray is the official color that we could all agree on. That's actually the name of the Sherwin-Williams color that we chose, not a sponsor. So I paid four painters for 2.5 days. That's how long it took to paint my downstairs world. But now
I was going to say, if they spent 2.5 days just painting your office, good Lord.
Good Lord. 19 coats. I don't know. They told me that's what I needed. I needed 19 coats, and I believe them. We should probably bring on our guest at this point and not bore people with my painting woes. He has been in IT for over 35 years. Currently focusing on infrastructure and data protection. Backup-wise, he goes all the way back to AIT, the Sony Drive. For those of you that might remember that, I'd love to hear about that a little bit. He is a Canadian living in France. Welcome to the podcast, Eric Abelson.
Hello there. Good to be here. And nice to meet both of you for the first time after many, many hours of podcast listening.
Long time listener, first time.
First time guest.
It's always nice to hear from a fan. I think we reached out to you because we saw, and I don't remember where or how I saw it, but I see way too many things. You wrote a blog post, which now I'm trying to pull it up in my.
It's on the using NAS as a Veeam hardened repository.
Yeah, I knew that was the title, but I was trying to pull up the page so that I could look at it. And yeah. I've only got 37 tabs open on my browser. So,
and I think it's actually hosted on your blog, right, Eric?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. So, which is over at infrageeks.com. And yeah, it was a cry of despair and needing something to help people that are trying to do backups on a shoestring, because one of the problems I run into very frequently is a lot of clients. I mean, I've got big clients too that will happily throw lots of money at the problem. And I've got lots of other clients that are like, please, oh, please, oh, please, I have no money. What can I do?
Right, right. And so this idea of using the Synology box, that's definitely a more budget-friendly device. Would you agree?
Oh, completely. That's been my big problem is a lot of these companies, and like I deal with like small city halls in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. and they just don't have the budget. And for some strange reason, Synology manages to sell a decent CPU with a reasonable amount of memory and a bunch of disks for considerably less than you would find an equivalent server, even from the better players like Supermicro that are not as offensive about charging you three times the cost of the same commodity disk as everyone else because it's got their special firmware.
Right. I've had experience with the Synology box as well here. Actually, there's one sitting behind me down on the floor. It's now a Deadology. But
that happens.
I have it, for the record, it didn't die. I just retired it. But yeah, I'm a fan of the Synology. And what, so it can do both SMB and NFS as well as iSCSI apparently.
That's correct. Well, the trick is that none of those are great protections if you want to use something with Veeam's immutable repository, which is becoming a priority for all of my clients and anyone in the backup business.
Yeah. And you know what, before we jump in, and by the way, I'm glad to hear that, right? Because, you know, it's something, as you know, that we've been preaching from this particular pulpit, if you will. Let's go back just a little bit. So you just to talk about, man, Sony AIT. I haven't heard that phrase in a long time. This is mid '90s, late '90s, right?
Yeah. Well, late '90s because the AIT one sucked.
Right.
The AIT two was actually pretty nice, but the golden solution was the AI two. Cat four tape autoloader. Sorry, I'm going to switch into French there from time to time. I say cat bande maybe. So it's
I'll take your word for it.
That's right. It was a four tape autoloader, and it changed the equation for me because all of a sudden we could get something like I think half a terabyte of compressed data, a little over that, into a tiny little box.
Right, right.
And it worked with Dance Retrospect, which I was playing with at the time because I built a backup solution for my division working at Nortel. And we were looking at the LTOs, and it was like, yeah, okay. And then we looked at the AITs, and it was like, ooh, I can build a business out of this, because if I lease these, I can probably work out the economies to go, Nortel will pay me X per machine backed up, and we can lease these and the 2CX computers to drive it.
Yeah, for those of you that were not aware of the AITs, they were, I'm pretty sure, they're the last helical scan drive that was manufactured for backup, right? So the
pretty much.
LTO and you know, the IBM drives and the storage tech drives, those are all linear drives. We had who was that persona that we had that
We had Mark Lance.
Yeah, and he actually gave us a technical reason why helical scan essentially went by the by, but AIT was the last of those.
By the way,
go ahead.
You should throw out our disclaimer.
Yeah, I have forgotten to throw out our disclaimer. Persona and I Work for different companies. He works for Zoom. I work for Druva. This is not a podcast of either company. And the opinions that you hear are ours. And also, be sure to rate us at ratethispodcast.com/restore. And if you, like Eric, are a longtime listener, and you know, or if you just joined us and you're like, I know about this stuff and I'm interested in backup and archive and security and all of those things, and just reach out to me at WC Preston on Twitter. I take all DMs. And or you can send an email to wcurtispreston@gmail.com. So let's move forward to the why has it become such a demand from your customers to secure their backup server?
Well, the biggest one, obviously, is you guys have been going on for a while, is we have to find the problem that people, and specifically, we're not dealing with the same kind of threats anymore. In the old days, your disaster recovery plan was all about the building blew up functionally in one way or another. That was the big disaster recovery plan. But it never included malicious intent where someone would go, ha-ha, not only am I going to take out your production system, but because I want to make your life miserable, I'm also going to go looking for your backup system. And that has changed the entire equation around how we have to protect our data these days. And just as an anecdote, I don't think I included that in my little note to you guys, but I spent about a year working with a company. I got called in after a massive ransomware attack to rebuild their backup infrastructure because it was a backup account that had admin rights everywhere that had been used to take everything out. And so, of course, since they started with the backups and then they ransomwared everything else, it took a year for several hundred sites for me to rebuild all of these branch offices all over the place. Some of them that were still using, believe it or not, the old tape rotation routine. And it was the secretary's responsibility to swap the tapes out on Friday. And guess how often that happened? Yeah, well. So nowadays, the key thing is we need to find ways to, well, functionally air gap. I will not go into the technical nitty gritty of it. But we need some way to say the data I put here can't be modified. Now, one obvious way is we've seen the cloud is a great solution for that. You can use just about every backup tool out there has some means of sending off to an S3 with the option to lock your objects so that they can't be modified, which is great. But there's a lot of companies that, despite everything, that gets expensive over time. The more data you keep, if you have long-term data retention plans or policies, that gets expensive. And so they're looking for, how can I do this on-site on a shoestring? So the trick was coming up with, well, a lot of my customers are very, I'm right into the VMware world with Veeam as the most predominant backup tool there. And they built this really nice immutable backup model, as long as you do it right.
We actually had Backup Dave on the podcast a while ago talking about the immutable repositories and things like that.
It does really stink that, you know, the thing that you said, that is absolutely the case that they're coming for your backups. And in many cases, you know, I was just looking at, there's actually another tool that we should probably talk about, which I don't know if you're aware. Have you heard of Blocky?
Blocky, that's Blocky. New to me.
So this, you can add this to your list. So it's literally called Blocky for Veeam. So it seems like it's a separate company, but it looks like it's, and I know this, I'm going to literally tell you the entire thing that I know, right? I haven't researched it that much, and we should probably have them on. But what it appears to be is a file system driver for Windows that locks the either an NTFS or a ReFS file system from any rights except for Veeam. And theoretically it could be used for other applications and other backup applications, and I'm guessing that they will do that, but they saw Veeam as the big one there, so they went after that. And so essentially it's a way to do what you're talking about doing on the Linux hardened repository, but doing it in Windows. So that's
that's actually
not a sponsor.
no, that's actually an interesting take, because it's true that there's a lot of places where they're Windows shops, and bringing Linux is like one of these, oh my God, this is one of those strange incantation things from the IT gurus are doing things. I don't understand it, and I'm very, very scared.
Yeah. What is a command line, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do I secure it and all the rest, right? It's like even managing it.
Yeah. How does that go over, like, Eric, because you've been dealing directly with these folks. how does that go? Or if they're an all Windows shop and you're bringing in a Linux box just for this?
Surprisingly low friction lately. The two pressures are, number one, oh my God, we need a solution.
Right.
there's nothing like the fear of losing everything to put people into a more open mindset for that kind of stuff. And the second one, and this is one of the nice things I like about this Synology approach, is Synology is an appliance. It's a box. You plug it in the network. You do whatever configuration needs doing, and then you basically forget about it. Mm-hmm. And that is actually what we're able to do with these companies that have limited budget. Say, look, it's just a Synology. I'm going to take advantage of some of the native features to use it to install a virtual machine on the Synology, and that will be the only point of access to the storage on the system. So we actually cut off all access to the DSM and the administration stuff. So the only port that's listening on this box is the one from the virtual machine listening for Veeam. So when you get it there and you just go, it's a box, it's an appliance, you go in your Veeam console and you say, what's the state of my backups? And says, here's the state of your backups. And they're like, great. Do I need to do a restore? Okay, you do a restore and everything works fine.
Treat it like a black box, right? They shouldn't care what's running in it, how it works, any of that stuff.
Exactly.
So, well, let me ask you about that. Push back just a little bit, because it's not really a black box, right? It is a Linux kernel that's running that needs to be administered and needs to be, like, there needs to be security patches and stuff put on it. How do you handle that if you're an all Windows shop?
Well, again, one of the nice parts of Synology is that they have actually a really decent user interface that even a Windows person will go, oh, it's just a web interface for my appliance. And I go in and there's a little thing that says there's an upgrade to be installed. So I click on the upgrade button and it does its thing. And I go for coffee and I come back and it's done. So that aspect of it is actually fairly easy for most people. But it has to be, like I said, because what we do is in this design, because the only thing I want actually on the network on a day-to-day basis is that Veeam repository. Mm-hmm. We actually disconnect, and I tell them this, no, physically, seriously, unplug the management port of the server.
Because I remember you saying that somewhere in the blog that you said the one thing that you didn't like was you couldn't turn that port off. Right.
There's going to be other network interfaces because I separate the backup flow on hopefully a 10 gig network and the admin flow just on a regular administrative VLAN somewhere. Mm-hmm. But since that time, and I have to update the blog article, I've discovered there are firewall rules that I could do to say, even if you come in through this interface you use the DHCP MDNS 169.254 whatever type address, we can actually block access to that management.
Oh, so you can. VLAN. Okay.
You can do good. It. Yep. That's okay. I have to go back and update.
So why don't you walk us through, because there were, so you talked about a couple of different things that you didn't do, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't do just an SMB. And by the way, thank you for saying SMB and not SIFS.
I'm preaching to another choir here. To all my NetApp brethren, no, SIFS is in the documentation. It's in the screenshots, but it is SMB, the protocol you're actually using.
Yeah, SMB, not SIFS.
One of Curtis's pet peeves.
Yeah.
Might as well.
Thank you very much for Stephen Foskett for hammering that into me. The and why not use just SMB or NFS?
Well, the first problem with SMB is just, especially with Veeam, it's horribly inefficient. Mm-hmm. It's just a catastrophe because when you're doing the way the incrementals work, there's commit stages where it's going to have to read a whole bunch of data and rewrite it back into big files. And you're just chewing up network bandwidth and disk IO left and right. It's just really inefficient. Aside from the fact that SMB is, I would not say horribly insecure, but it's probably not the most secure protocol you have out there. And I don't recall that NFS is actually any better with Veeam from a practical standpoint, except that the only difference is you have to front it with a Linux machine anyway. So you're not gaining anything by using NFS in that context.
Okay.
So the key thing there was just say, get rid of all your NAS protocols. Then you have the option, like you pointed out, there is iSCSI available on this thing. And what I used to see people doing with this was they'd take their Synology box or their NAS box, whatever they had, and they'd say, present an iSCSI volume as a raw device map to a Linux virtual machine. And that will be my hardened repository. I will configure it properly and do all that stuff, and we're good to go. The hiccup, as I've run into, is I had the pleasure of helping a client out of a ransomware attack over the holidays this year, and their attack vector was not just the system layer. They actually attacked the ESX servers directly.
And there's a lot of zero days out there now coming out, right, around against VMware. So
yeah, most of it's against the desktop stuff. There's less on the actual ESX level. But the problem is all it takes is someone that gets an admin account off one of those other systems, and that admin account is admin on your vCenter. And then from there, you just turn on SSH in all the boxes. You go in and you run this little ransomware, the encryption tool. And what do they do? Well, they just look at all the available disks where all the VMs live.
So I don't think you mentioned when you said they build a Linux, I don't think you mentioned that it was a VM, but maybe did.
Yep.
No, so that's what you meant. You meant a Linux VM. And so then it got attacked via ESX. So that's a bad idea.
That's right.
Trying to eliminate catch 22s, right?
Exactly. So the other option is if you've got the money, you could just throw a physical box in front of your Synology and treat it as cheap storage. That works well.
But then these are probably shops which may not want to be managing a Linux box. And now you have a physical system. You got to procure during supply chain issues. What's the right equipment? All the rest of that, right?
Those are exactly the points that keep coming up. It's like, well, why am I throwing extra money to buy a network card and CPU and memory when I just bought a box that has a network card and CPU and memory in it? That's kind of silly.
So I think the surprise for me was this idea that you could run the Linux on the Synology box itself. I think that was
the one thing I discovered about a year ago, was that the machines are getting more and more capable, and they all basically, everybody's a hypervisor now. I mean, if you're going to Linux,
I'm a hypervisor. I mean, literally, that's right. Just look at me.
You've got KVM, QEMU, you've got everything you could possibly want on just about any OS. So the Synology said, well, we'll just put a nice pretty wrapper on it so that it's easy to approach and you can just deploy a VM inside there. And then it's like, oh, and it's inside the machine and I can give it access to all the storage. And then I don't need the DSM other than just to do the basic configuration to sort of bootstrap myself to a point where I've got a Linux box talking to all my storage.
By the way, Persona, you didn't ask him what a DSM is. Normally that's your job.
Oh, yeah. So what's a DSM, Eric?
Oh, whoops. Yes. Acronym City. We are always living in it. Is the Disk Station Manager, I think is the Synology term for it, which is basically their proprietary layer or interface layer on top of their Linux kernel. So it's the web UI that drives all the stuff when you're playing with Synology boxes.
Gotcha. And it's kind of cool that they're giving you this capability. If I think about it, it's kind of like how for vCenter, right? You have your ESXi host, right? And then you're doing whatever you want. Now it's like, oh, here's storage. And now you can run some additional compute against it, right? And take advantage of it. The one question I would have, though, is in these environments where you're deploying Synology plus a Veeam hardened repository together, I'm assuming you're only dedicating that for backup storage, correct? And you don't necessarily want it for being used for primary NAS storage as well, right?
Exactly. No, that's precisely the objective here is like, see, people are coming and going, I need to revamp my backup storage. I need to do something. And my objective in these cases is we'll buy you a box. It will do this. It will do nothing else but this. You can buy another Synology if you want to do file shares and all that other fun stuff, which is fine. But this box should live and breathe only your backup storage. Yeah. So the idea is it's just cut off from the rest of the world. It does one thing and one thing only. It's the strange part is just the economics of it, in that you can buy a Synology with 12 decent-sized hard drives in it or 16 decent-sized hard drives for considerably less than you can buy just about any off-the-shelf brand-name server right now. That's where the kicker comes in. Which
especially
is why
a server with a bunch of storage.
Yes. I don't know. It's still cheaper than a storage bay. I just did a couple of quotes the other day. I was like, I want a storage bay with this kind of capacity. And they're like, oh, that'll be 40,000 euros. And I said, okay, well, I want a server with the same amount of disks in it. And I'm going to throw TrueNAS or something on there just for something else. And they're like, oh, well, that'll be 14,000 euros. And I'm like, Okay, I know you've got dual controllers, but I could go to iX Systems and probably get myself the same thing for the same price. So, yeah, it's there's some really strange economics that are in play as soon as you start talking to brand name enterprise providers in the storage front.
Interesting. And so I guess the part I'm not fully grasping, and mainly it's because I didn't even know that Synology could do this. This VM, and again, I'm going to mm-hmm. poke at you again, just because I want to make sure I understand what we're talking about here. Yeah. You talked about Synology's ability to update the kernel, or at least that's what I was understanding you. So help me understand that there. Is this Linux box not, is the VM, the kernel inside that VM, not something that will get out of date, or is that something that the customer can manage without having to know too much about Linux?
That one actually does require a little bit more handholding and some documentation, because there's two steps. Because if I do this properly, this machine is cut off from the network. And I have two things that I'm going to potentially need to upgrade. You're absolutely correct. I have to potentially upgrade the DSM. Although on the practical front, I'm not so much worried about the security problems on the Synology interface, because most of the time it's disconnected. Okay. So it should be one of those things that they get the mail from Synology going, woohoo, new update here. It's like, oh, okay, I better go connect my machine and do that update thing. On the Linux side, again, you're doing off the shelf, the most standard vanilla clean install you can possibly do. So the only thing we need to get in the documentation to say is, if you're using an Ubuntu system, it's just going to be going apt-get update, apt-get upgrade, reboot, and you're done. So that should be the sum total of the user's interaction with that side of things.
What about the Veeam specific pieces?
That is a little bit more complicated. Good call, Prasanna. Yeah.
But that's something you're only going to have to do once, though, right?
Until there's a Veeam update.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Because Veeam is actually fairly finicky about the notion of different components in its system not running exactly the same version. Mm. So what it's got is, I think what's called the data mover is what they install on the repository component. You're talking to it over the backup network, so it's already on the network. You don't need to touch the Synology layer at this point. But what you do need, because it's an immutable repository, and this applies to all the Linux hardened repository configurations, is you need to go to the console, you need to enable SSH, then you go to the Veeam console and you say, do my update thing, use this account and password, but don't remember it, whatever you do. And that's one mm-hmm. of the things that makes it a hardened repository, is that Veeam has no trace and no memory of the accounts and the passwords that are used for connecting it. Because once they've done the first stage, basically what they do is a key exchange. So any other further communication is done over that certificate exchange process to go, hi, I'm your Veeam server. And hi, I'm a repository. Are you really the Veeam server? Okay, you've got the right key. Are you really the right repository? Yes, you've got the right key. We're good. We're golden. No passwords were ever exchanged.
Gotcha. And so the only time you need it is for the upgrade part, where you need to enable SSH. You do the upgrade, which looks like it's automated from the Veeam side, as long as you can connect. And then once that update is done, then I'm guessing you go back and you disable SSH and you're all good to go.
That's right. So it's basically, you're absolutely right. There's a few more commands. There's the apt-get update, upgrade, reboot. And then there's SSH, no, system control server, no, system control start, can't remember which one of the order of those ones. System control SSH start, do your upgrade, system control SSH stop. Gotcha. Should do the job.
And you're doing this from the console that you're accessing via the DSM.
That's correct. So you will have to plug it back into the network for those operations.
Yeah, so you plug that back. So you then load the DSM, which is over a browser, right? I'm going to access this via browser.
That's right.
So I got to plug in the management port, access DSM, look at the terminal, the console via that interface, turn on SSH, do my update, and then turn it off. So it's not nothing, but it's not crazy either. Okay.
No, and it's the sort of thing that actually companies that like procedures, they like it because it's really straightforward. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. you tell me I do this, 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 and I get the results I want. And they're like, oh, I can follow procedures and I can give this to, you know, any of my tech sysadmins. And they'll go, oh, yeah, I get it. No problem. It's like I said, it's not rocket science, but it
is. And then once you've done that, the protocol that is used to transfer backups to the Veeam hardened Linux repository is the Veeam protocols. It's not using NFS or SMB or anything like that.
Exactly. It's the Veeam Data Mover protocol.
Right. Okay.
Which is, up until now, has not been subject to any CVEs. So I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that nobody starts attacking that one seriously.
On July 6th, 2022. as of this recording.
So what is, hold on, Prasanna, now it's my turn. CVE is common vulnerability something. I don't remember what the last one is.
Vulnerabilities and exposures.
And exposures. Okay. So yes, that's the nomenclature for security flaws that we have found and discovered and decided how bad they are.
Sorry.
You have this one Synology box, right, with your Veeam hardened backup repository for these customers on a shoestring budget. I know Curtis loves, I'm going to steal your line, Curtis. He loves a 3-2-1 rule. So what do you do with that backup once it lands on that immutable repository?
Well, there's basically the logical next step is to find some kind of S3 provider that will do immutable backups. Now, I've got a number of companies that, for whatever reason, the cloud stuff is just not an option. Specifically government agencies. And here in France, it's actually very specific. It's not always to do with the security. It has a lot more to do with procurement processes.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'll give you the 10-cent tour is that city halls, their taxes are split into two types, one which comes from property taxes, and I forget which the other one comes from. But these two tax streams are split into what they can spend on CapEx and OPEX. And the problem is the one that is for OPEX is just peanuts. So the problem is they can't actually get, even if they find a right way to buy it, they can't buy a lot of cloud services because they're considered operation expenses. So that they can buy hardware. That's not a problem. But they can't buy an ongoing service.
That's hilarious, actually. Yeah, it's like the exact opposite of what you see in the U.S.
Exactly. Everyone says, oh, I want to level my budget so it's always a continuous operating thing. But there's this strange tax laws here that make it that City Hall has lots of money to spend on hardware, but they're not allowed to spend. Well, traditionally, it was to stop abuse of things like having people on salary that really weren't doing any work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think it's really to keep a limit on the headcount and limit on anything that goes in that operations expense side of the house. But if you need to throw money at a solution, it has to be physical hardware. So what I've been doing, and I don't know if you've gone through the next step of my blog, which is, well, can I build myself my own S3 immutable object storage system? And it turns out there's lots of good solutions that do that.
Are there affordable ones to do that?
Oh, completely. Okay. The most affordable is the fact that MinIO is available for free. They have an open source version, which does everything the main one does, but obviously no support. You can pay for support from them if you want that. But all it takes is, and here we go back to a Linux box or several Linux boxes, depending on how you want to roll the thing. But yeah, you can use the MinIO solution, and I've got actually I like to tinker with hardware. This is the thing, everyone, because it's the software is eating the world, but I like to play with hardware. So I do stupid things with hardware. So I have a mobile NAS, which is basically a 9th generation Intel NUC that comes with Thunderbolt. And so with Thunderbolt, I can connect all sorts of daisy-chained strange disk systems on this. OWC makes some wonderful ones where I can get these little 4-bay 2.5-inch drive systems for my high-performance SSDs and great big 8-bay 3.5-inch drives. And so I use this for a lot of clients that are looking for swing space. And so I said, oh, let's see how far I can push this with MinIO. So currently, I took that NUC through a MinIO instance on it and 8 to 12 terabyte hard drives. And so I've got this 96 terabyte MinIO instance hanging out for a client right now that's migrating a whole bunch of data.
Nice.
And these are the kind of things you got to do when you can't get the cloud.
Yeah. But it's fun. And I had to 3D print a whole container to hold it all in, put a handle on it.
3D printed the container?
I will send you photos.
You weren't kidding when you said you like to tinker with the hardware.
It's lots of fun. Yeah.
So actually,
but it comes in handy.
Yeah. So speaking of Veeam and Object Store, I actually don't know if you heard, but the former Veeam founders, they started their own company where they're building a S3 repository or an Object Store repository just for Veeam.
Oh, cool. Well, there's a good business to be had there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as long as it's cheaper than Amazon.
whether or not it'll be, you know, in that affordable category that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the big trick there is that, let's face it, storage itself is cheap. And if you're not looking at high performance stuff, throwing 8, 12, 14, 16 terabyte drives into a system, that gets you a long way. So it's being able to throw a reasonable amount of CapEx at it, and the problem goes away for another 5 years. Yeah. And the way MinIO works, you can swap those drives out, and it'll auto-rebuild and do all its fancy stuff. So assuming CMR disks with larger capacities still exist, because obviously throwing the SMR drives in these things is just catastrophe.
What are SMR and CMR?
Yeah.
And why explain what
you just said.
I'll start with the first part because that's the easy one. The MinIO backend uses erasure coding to spread parity across the disk. So it is a reliable system, and it goes fairly far in that front, similar to ZFS, that it will actually go run down all the data that's stored and make sure that everybody is in agreement on the checksums and stuff like that. So it's, in this particular context, very close to ZFS from a bit rot reliability standpoint.
Shingled magnetic recording. This is the one that's basically made for long-term storage, right? Because you have to, it's got like multiple layers.
Yeah, there's too many tracks. I mean, it's like the tape drives. There's too many tracks overlapping and close to each other.
Right, right. And so CMR is?
The old stuff, right?
The old stuff. It is... Traditional? No. Traditional doesn't have a C in it.
I think it's like conventional.
That may be it. Conventional magnetic recording.
With the shingled it's literally like layers on top of layers. And to change a layer that's under it, I don't understand how it works at all. But it sounds like you would only use it if you're going to write and never modify, right?
Exactly.
Or hardly ever modify. Which is not a backup configuration.
Well, and the problem really is the software needs to be aware. I mean, it's like any modern storage bay that's built for SSDs. Like, it's going to optimize for 4K writes. It's going to optimize for making erasure blocks in 4K chunks so that it uses the system the way it's meant to be used. And SMR is in the same kind of category that if your software knows that that's the underlying storage and is designed for it, awesome. I mean... That's Amazon. That's Dropbox, because Dropbox did a huge investment in custom code to handle those kind of drives. But for your average off-the-shelf enterprise software, they're not there yet.
Right, right. And so, yeah, so you want to use conventional drives, not SMR drives. And that is definitely a mistake that a budget-conscious consumer or budget-conscious business or government would do, right?
I actually have one client that was caught up in the Western Digital fiasco that they were wondering why their NAS was just horrible performance. And it's because Western Digital at a moment sold a whole bunch of SMR drives with the same part number as the CMR drives.
This was a mistake.
This was confusing for everybody involved.
Yeah. Did they find out if this was intentional or not?
I don't know what the final upshot on the story is, but all I know is that right now there are specific drive serial, or not serial numbers, but actual model numbers. You go, if you have one of these, take it out and put a real disk in.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting. We should probably get from you a couple of links of the object projects that you've been playing with.
Yeah, the big
ones. I'm aware of are the ones that are too expensive.
I mean, there's the Dell ECS, there's the Storage Grid from NetApp. There's as soon as I cite those names, all of a sudden the enterprise price tag just showed up.
Yep.
Yeah.
And also the biggest problem I have with a lot of them is just the minimum point of entry, because of the way they're designed. I think the smallest ECS instance they'll sell you is something like 60 terabytes, but it's got to be with 3 nodes. Yeah. And those 3 nodes each have, dual 10 or 25 gig. I mean, just the price specs just exploded.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm going, look, you can buy an Intel NUC with Thunderbolt and throw 8 drives in the back of it and have 100 terabytes of usable storage right away. And it'll cost you, I don't know, I think it, well, the discs are expensive, but I don't think I paid more than about 4,000 euros for the whole kit. And it does the job.
By the way, I just want to have a little fun with you. I don't think we needed to tell people that you were Canadian because your accent comes through.
Accent.
Whatever you say about or process or OPEX. When you said, I've actually never heard anybody say OPEX before.
Yeah, OPEX, just, OPEX, tomato, tomato.
Yeah. Yeah. I love my friends to the north. One concern that I have just slightly, it's just a slight bone that I pick with the folks with the, you know, the hardened Linux repository. A lot of people call it immutable because they're using the immutable flag. And I like to point out that, well, as long as no one has root, right?
Bingo.
Because you can unset all those immutable flags. Right.
Well, I can do better than that. I can just go in and hose the drives themselves.
Yeah. Just do NUFIS. Yeah.
DD input file equals dev null. Output file equals / SDA, SD1, SD2. Go to town.
Please do not try that. So it's a lot easier. Immutable repositories.
Yeah.
We will not be liable.
Don't try this at home.
Eric. So it's. I just want to make that point. And this is one of those differences between those enterprise level things, right? Is that they can produce an appliance that you don't have that kind of access to. Right.
But I think though, for your point though, Curtis, I think with the proposal that Eric's recommending, right, the fact that your management port is disconnected, the fact that SSH is disconnected for all times other than the period when you have to do the updates, right, at least reduces some amount of risk. It doesn't completely eliminate it, but it does reduce it significantly. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a great design. It's as good as this design can get. I guess my only point is you're still not protected against Eric going nuts.
Yes.
Right?
If
Eric has root and he decides to wipe out your data, there's nothing that's going to stop him.
Exactly. Although, if we go to the logical extreme, which is physically disconnecting that cable for the management port, it means I need to have physical access. So that does...
That is a very good point, Eric. And of course, we all know that physical access, all bets are off.
But it trumps everything. It trumps everything.
I mean, physical access, all I need is a torch. I don't need a password.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't have to be sophisticated. A couple of wire bolt cutters and or just a big heavy magnet, and I just run that across all those hard drives. And I mean,
another thing, do not try that at home.
There's a special person who loves thermite on his hard drives.
We've had a thermite lover on the podcast, Howard Marks.
Yes,
who works, by the way, at Vast Data, who one of those places that have a way too big of a, you know, that you're the initial block that you have to buy is way too big for anything you're interested in. But I've seen him. He actually made a video where he got hired by a company to put thermite on some servers to destroy them and have the whole HA process kick in. And
if you're looking for lots of S3 storage, Vast Data will do the job. My only issue is that I believe the current entry point is about a half a petabyte storage.
Something like that. It's called Vast Data. It's not called slightly large data.
And I think that they might have recently just come out with smaller nodes, entry-level nodes.
He did say that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It might only be 200 terabytes.
Yeah, it might still be 200 terabytes, which is probably still way too large. Right. But
for many environments,
Yes.
Probably, yeah. But
That's the interesting part about the way the market's been going is that you've got this. I mean, the traditional thing is, what's the backbone of most countries' businesses? It's small business.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got all these companies spending tons and tons of time and money and effort on building solutions for the big enterprises. And the problem is what I'm seeing more and more is that the small enterprise are the poor guys that are getting the short end of the stick going, I mean, Vast Data, I will be first one to tell you, I've been talking to Mark. I have seen the tech field. I was present at some of the Tech Field Day presentations. It's amazing technology.
Yeah.
It just doesn't scale down. And the problem is that we have this huge mass of companies out there that are everything from mom and pop shops to even like a 100-person shop, but their total data footprint is measured in 10, 20, 30, 40 terabytes.
Yeah, I say it a lot that for every one enterprise that needs a Vast Data, there are 99, you know, smaller companies that also have a need to protect their data. And I think that's one of the things I like about working about Dhruva is that we do scale up, but we scale down all the way down, right? The only thing that limits us in a small environment is just the business processes, right? So we don't sell direct to consumer. We don't sell to like a two-person business kind of thing, right? Just because of the paperwork issues. But technologically speaking, we can back up a single computer, right? Yeah. And we don't need that on-premises hardware and all that. So I like the way that we do scale down and we can handle those SMBs just fine. Yeah.
So that's always one of the things that, like I said, Dhruva has been one of those solutions on my radar. But again, like I explained for a lot of these city halls, they just can't take advantage of that kind of
solution. Yeah, that part of your conversation hurt me. I was like, well, that explains why we're not big in France. I actually have no idea if we're big in France or not. But
yeah, well, it's not the same for regular companies. It's strictly a city hall type business.
Oh, it's a city hall. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it's at the city level that those rules are in place.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Yeah. So probably we're doing just fine in France. I know that we do deal with data sovereignty problems really well because we basically run in all of the, you know, the AWS regions, right? So people that are concerned. Back in the day, I remember you were in Canada when we came out with the Patriot Act in the US and that made storing data in the US verboten for anybody outside of the US, right? So we don't have that issue because we've got, you know, we're running in your local AWS region.
Yeah, data doesn't go across regions unless there's a BGP routing mishap, but oh well.
What can you do about that? Yeah. Don't do that. Any final thoughts you have, Eric, on this blog post?
Or just general
Veeam backups to that in general?
Well, Veeam has always been fun. I'm always on the lookout for new and interesting ways to do stuff. And as you guys have now motivated me, it's time for me to write up some more detail on the MinIO TrueNAS because there's some new stuff on that front. For the S3 backup repositories. And the one thing is, once you get hooked on this idea of protecting data is important, it never leaves you. I mean, it's been 30 plus years that I had my first, we put up a new server that everybody thought was the greatest thing since sliced bread. It was a copy of what was called Meeting Manager at the time. And basically it was the precursor to Outlook with shared calendars.
Mm.
And it was on a single machine and all the executives loved it. And every month in the monthly meeting, I came and said, we don't have a backup of this machine until the day the hard drive died. And then I got the budget to buy my tape drive. And ever since that time, it's been my hobby horse is looking around and going, is that protected? And that's now open up to the security aspect of things, but it's always like, is your data safe? And once you get hooked, you can't get rid of it.
If you've listened to the podcast, you probably heard me say that we used to have this guy, his name was Joe Fitzpatrick, and he was always the guy in the meeting that he would raise his hand. He'd say, are we getting this on tape? Right. That was the phrase back in the day. Right.
Yeah.
That is one part that hasn't changed about backups since I joined the industry back in 93 is that, you know, no one wants to be the backup person. No one wants to pay for the backups. It's the last thing that anybody thinks about when they're deploying a new system. In reality, it should be the first thing they think about, right? If they start protecting it as the system is being developed in-house, it'll just be automatically protected. I think about, we had a very boring naming convention back at MBNA, which is the bank that I worked at. It was, you had HPFS01, right? HP file server 01 or HPDB01, right? And I remember, and so what I started seeing was that new systems were getting deployed, and I, the person in charge of backups, wasn't being told that they existed. And so I created this form that you had to fill out. This is pre-web, right? So there was literally a physical form that you had to fill out. And on the form, it said, this form is not complete until you have a signed copy back from me that acknowledges that I received the form. You can't just say, oh, I filled out the form, right? Because what when I implemented this form was somebody asked me for a restore from HPDB SVK, right? HP Database Server K. And I this is the weird things that you remember. I remember that it was K. And I go, so K? You're like, yeah. I've never heard of K. In fact, the last server I remember hearing about was H. So that means there's an I and a J and a K, none of which are being backed up. That was the day that I implemented that form, right? Because people just don't think about backups.
Yep.
No, nope. We do.
We do all the time.
You want us on that wall. You need us on that wall. I'm sorry. I went with a few good men there for a second.
Yep.
Yes. Well, anyway, thanks, Eric, so much for coming on the podcast.
A pleasure.
And Prasanna, as always, great questions.
I try. And thanks, Eric. And looking forward to seeing your object store article. And maybe we can have you back on the podcast.
Sounds good.
Absolutely. And thanks again to our listeners. You know, you're why we're here. Otherwise, we're just a couple of folks talking to each other.
I like talking to people.
Absolutely. And be sure to subscribe so that you can restore it all.